Not taking up any more time, I'd like to introduce Martin Tanner to y'all.
Tonight I thought we would do something that I've actually wanted to do at one of these meetings for a long, long time, which is to talk about some of the aspects of near-death experiences and what they mean in a little bit more depth, because we hear all these experiences and we just kind of, it's a little bit like driving to work every day or whatever else you do, you kind of do it without thinking so much about it. And I think there are a lot of lessons that we could learn from that. So that's the purpose of the meeting tonight. And I've actually, ahead of time, invited a few people to share some aspects of near-death experiences that are a bit unusual. Before we start, though, I'm going to ask for a raise of hands. If you don't want to participate, you don't have to. It's no big deal. All I'm going to ask for is your social security number and your contact. I'm kidding. No. How many people here have read more than or heard from different sources more than a dozen near-death experiences? Everybody. How about more than 20? Still a lot of people. How about more than 50? Now we're starting to get a little bit more scarce. Who has talked to or read more than 100 near-death experiences? Still a few. Okay. How about 16,000? No. Okay. Gotcha. Finally we got, okay, the hands are not, all right. So we have a fairly knowledgeable group here. Who has heard an experience where at the time the person died or began to have their experience, they heard some kind of a noise, the part of the experience about the noise? Any volunteers?
Some kind of buzzing, kind of irritating, kind of buzzing kind of noise is one thing.
And that is often the way it is. Sure, let's try another description. What did you hear?
Several that I've read, not many, but several have described a whooshing sound, like wind or a whoosh.
Whooshing sound. I talked to one gentleman who said it was like a clicking sound or, you know, almost like grasshoppers or crickets or something at night, some kind of a buzzing sound. At any rate, we've heard these descriptions. So what does it mean? Why would somebody at the point of death hear some kind of a noise? I won't take any concrete answers. Only speculation is allowed. Because honestly, we really don't know. That's all we can do is speculate.
Because they have acute sensory perception.
Okay, but what is the clicking sound? What are they hearing?
Well, I've heard someone talk about bells, too.
Okay, you're right. And a number of people have heard bells. Some people have described it as music. There was actually a presenter at one of the national conferences that had just focused on this and tracked down music that they thought sounded like this sound or this event.
I thought it could be something very simple. They just heard some noise that was in their environment.
Okay.
Like a car driving by or somebody, I don't know, the clicking sound I couldn't explain, a whooshing sound, something causing a wind.
So you would think it's something from this world, possibly.
Right.
Any other ideas? From this world, something from the next world?
As meditation practice progresses, one of the stages of meditation includes a buzzing noise as one. It's not universal, but at a certain stage of evolution, awareness of that buzzing noise also occurs.
Okay, so you think it's just a background noise that's always there, and at a certain point, if you meditate enough, maybe you can tap into it or hear it? Is that a fair summary?
Don't know enough to be able to speculate.
Okay. Any other comments?
It seems like one of the early chroniclers of it, and I don't know if it was Moody or Ring, but they described hearing a number of accounts where it was a loud buzzing noise in the locality of the ear, right above the ear, and it was also a vibration that the person felt. And the speculation is, get ready, something's happening.
No. There you go. Okay, one or two more comments. Sure.
He just mentioned it. Did anybody ever talk about a vibrating sensation?
Yes, Vibration, some kind of a vibration, sensation, sure.
Good.
Could it be some kind of an energy source that makes a sound?
It obviously has to be. Any other thoughts about where it might come from or what it might be?
I personally was dead, and when I came back, I tried to convince myself it was my imaginations, but my thoughts are it was all the stupid machines I was hooked up to that wouldn't shut up when I was trying to die.
The experience, okay, that may very well be exactly what happened for you. I am convinced from interviewing several people that there are a few different things going on here. You hear kind of a general background noise once you have left your body, and that seems to be a background noise or something that's present in the next life. Before that happens, or at the time you seem to be leaving your body, several of the people that I've interviewed have said that this clicking sound or this buzzing sound or this sort of an obnoxious noise, I could pull out a couple of comments here and read them. They're quite interesting. They've said that it was what sound they heard that their spirit made as it detached from their physical body. You pull your foot out of boots that are really tight and you get this and you're out. The speculation that a few of these people made is that that's what they heard as their spirit detached from their physical body. True or not, I don't know, because everyone, including those people who said that, although they have a little bit more experience than the rest of us because that was their own experience, I guess it's still rank speculation like most of what will be going on tonight. But does that kind of make sense as a possibility?
I have a raw speculation.
Yes.
Because except for one case that I read about, one of the surprising things about NDE is that the ego survives death. So that's you as you, hugging Jesus. And the brain, and they've never found the self center in the brain. So it appears that the brain is just the interface to these flesh robots we're wearing. And what goes out during stroke is like speech and movement. And so that as your spirit, just speculating, is leaving, perhaps something is triggering your hearing center as it detaches. Anyway.
That's even more detailed thought about it. Thank you. Thank you for that. So maybe it's a little bit more like, pulling the plug out of a wall, something along those lines. That's where your spirit interfaces inside your brain or hooks up to your body somehow. And when it's removed, that is the sound that you hear. Next thought. One of the most fascinating experiences that I ever heard was from a guy who used to be part of our group here who had cystic fibrosis. And he finally passed away. As far as I know, he was the oldest person who had cystic fibrosis. He lived to be, I think it was real close to 40, which is quite unusual. Most people would die much younger from that horrible disease. At any rate, he had a wife and two children, and he had had a near-death experience and became part of our group and described his experience. And then he said, if I ever have another one, I'm going to check out all kinds of things because I have all these questions now. He said, I want to know what this tunnel thing is. What in the world is the tunnel? And so I thought before I tossed out what he said that I would ask, have any of you heard, we've all heard, you die, your spirit leaves your body. At least some people go through a tunnel, or some of them describe it as a tube or a valley or a dark hallway. What is this tube or tunnel? I even heard one lady who was around and watching a lot of TV in the 60s say, did you ever see that TV show called The Time Machine that had the little circles like going around? She says, it was kind of like that. What do you think the tunnel is?
Well, since I've had a near death, I refer to that place they're calling as a corridor.
Corridor, okay.
And I call it a corridor because when I had that, I was not in my body. I was in a suspended state, so to speak, but I could see my body, and I could also see the light off to my left where I could go. So I call it a corridor, which is the passage point here between there and going beyond that.
That is the way that you get from this life to the next one? You know, obviously, it's not a specific place, because when we die, we don't all go waltzing off to a corridor that's somewhere on, you know, 3rd West and 7200 South or something. There's a corridor for each person. What do you think it is?
I have heard several accounts that somebody stopped and felt it, actually felt it, and it was a living membrane. It actually had life itself, like an energy. So it was incredible somebody even stopped to actually experience that, you know, to have your presence of mind on the other side as you're going through to stop to feel this wonder of a living membrane.
Thank you. That's great. Yes.
That's part of my own experience, which was not an extensive one, but since that part was early on that I reaccessed meditatively again and again. And in my experience, which occurred when I was 10 years old, it was the tunnel. You would call it a tunnel, but it was made without hands. It didn't have sheer dimensions. But I noticed beings, humans, that were on the outside of the tunnel, not really trying to get in. It was as if they were stuck psychologically, mentally, etc., distance up there, the light. And one of the thoughts that I've had is that it's a barrier to protect those newly entering into this media, this new space, even such as myself, a child, from the potential of an evil influence, something that they didn't deserve, you know, that predators of some kind, and to protect them. And also that's part of the noticing that occurs, noticing that you're moving, but you're not walking. Noticing around you, well, you know, up ahead, there's a light. So you're attracted, and you notice as you mentally think, I'm going to go up there, you begin to accelerate, that you have control mentally over motion. You're not pulled like a tractor beam through that tunnel. You move. Some describe moving very fast. Some describe moving slow. I've never heard of anybody backing up unless their near-death experience ended. You know, it was a brief encounter, and you come back, and you go, what was that?
Thank you. Very, very perceptive thoughts. And anyone else like to add here? Our group member who had cystic fibrosis, who died a second time, said that on his way up through the tunnel, he stopped and he was able to feel it. And it was something that he could touch, at least with his spiritual body, his spirit self, and that it had texture to it. I asked him what kind, and he said, I can't, it's something totally unearthly, and that's, but it was something that was real. It wasn't just my imagination. It wasn't just light. There was something real about it. And this last comment that was made by our audience member seems to fall in line with something that I speculated about, and that is that it indeed is a corridor. And if you think about a freeway, or a hallway that you walk down, it's there to direct you to the right place. It's there in time of winter time, or, you know, even in the summertime, to give you some kind of protection or to keep you on path. But just like with the road, you can sometimes see outside of it. And that's the only analogy I can come up with, is that it is something that, that might be a protection. It's something that directs the right people through there. Another observation I have is that people who have negative near-death experiences, and of course those are not too frequent, but they happen occasionally, they don't wind up in the tunnel. The tunnel seems to be something that heads towards the being of light. Howard Storm's account, when he died in his hospital bed and went to kind of a dark, evil place, he just described going out off into the mist. There was no tunnel. There was nothing that drew him away. He went to a different place. So this corridor that we call a tunnel seems to go towards a good place, and Martin, it seems to insulate you from some of the negative places. Yes?
Martin, I remember Howard Storm talking about that hall. He went out into the hall, and the hall was round. It had rounded corners. So in sort of a way...
Well, you know, maybe I missed that. Maybe you do go through a tunnel to the negative places.
Well, I mean, he described it as sort of tunnel-like, although he didn't describe it as a tunnel. It looked odd. It didn't look like the old hall he knew. So... And George Ritchie speculated when he was here that the tunnel was a means of protecting people who are going over to the other side.
Interesting. Yes?
When I had my near-death experience, I didn't experience a tunnel. I was immediately in the light in this wonderful place. So I'm not, but I made a decision to go. I was asked before I left the hospital room, I was out of my body, was asked if I was finished, was I ready to go? And then I was like, yes. And then I was immediately in a new body. And then I was in the light in this incredible place. And everything was alive. Just to make it more difficult for you to explain that.
Well, like I said, tonight, a lot of speculation. But hopefully we'll think a bit more about some of the aspects of the near-death experiences that people describe. Yes.
I hate to say it, but it should represent a vagina and a membrane.
Well, we now have this on tape, so.
What?
And from a doctor, he's an MD.
From a doctor, an MD. There you, that works for me.
Maybe from Mother Nature.
Well, that would be true. If we arrive that way, that would be the way we leave. Yes, ma'am.
Mine is just a question. I've been coming for several months now, and none of the experiences that have been talked about have experienced that tunnel. That, you know, so I haven't heard of that. My question is, how frequent is that? Like, is there like a percentage of people that experience that corridor or tunnel versus those who, like her, just walk into?
Go ahead, Bill.
Arvin Gibson, who was one of our board members, as well as quite a researcher on the subject of near-death experiences, actually did a study regarding statistical information on aspects of near-death experiences. As I recall, I think he said somewhere around 18-20% of people will experience the tunnel. There are about 20 elements that are used to kind of qualify an experience as a near-death experience. Not everybody has all 20 elements, obviously. So, I mean, there are different things. But that one thing, I mean, you would think it would be very common because that's kind of something that the media and a lot of people really kind of focus on is this tunnel and the light. But the reality is it's really only about 18-20%.
Thank you. Other comments? Yes.
I have a comment question. It's my understanding from what I have read and heard that there is, in reality, no correlation between the kind of NDE experience that one has. There's no correlation between that and what church he goes to or what religion he embraces. I'm originally from Bible Belt country, and down there they pound the pulpit and say, he who goes to this church is going to heaven. He who goes to that church is going to you know where, and to one place.
You're
going to
have
another,
a great experience, no, and if you're part of another one, you're going to really. That's right. That's exactly right. One of the things that does, however, happen and is correlated with your religious background is that And Bill mentions this, and I'm not sure how deeply it sinks in each month as he gives his introduction, but the way people interpret anything in life can only come from their experience. Ask a baby who's a week old to interpret anything, and you're not going to get much of a response because they don't even have enough experience to use language yet. But finally, when someone has enough experience so that they can express themselves through language and through their own life, then they can converse about things. But it's only based on the experience that they have. After all, how could you talk about something based on no experience at all? And so what happens, bringing it back to your comment about religion, I've only talked to two people who were Muslims who have had near-death experiences. One of them has since moved to California, but he lived in Logan, Utah. And every time someone would talk about seeing Jesus in their near-death experience, he would just come unglued. No, it's not Jesus, it's Muhammad, or it's the angel of God. He had his own interpretation. But when you got right down to the details, it wasn't that he saw something that was so different. It was the way he interpreted the experience based on his own religious background and training. And people who have a Hindu or a Buddhist background or whatever background it might be will tend to interpret a near-death experience from that background. The interesting ones for me are people who were atheists who thought there was no afterlife and then have had near-death experience. There was a gentleman who spoke to us many years ago named David Herard, who was a very kind of angry man because he grew up in New York and saw several of his friends killed in gang incidents. And so he joined the military so that he could go over to Vietnam and shoot people and not go to jail for it. I mean, he was a very angry guy. He was a very angry and unhappy guy. And he didn't think there was an afterlife. And if he died, he would have been fine with it. And he just thought that would be the end of this horrible, difficult existence. And he had his near-death experience. And he was very shocked and surprised when he ran into this loving, kind being of light. And somewhat similar to Howard Storm's experience. Howard Storm was kind of a self-described atheist when he had his experience. So some things in experience can definitely change your outlook on life, but you would still have to interpret them somehow based on your experience. Everyone's experienced love. They know what love feels like when they have it from some supreme being. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I did have a negative experience, and I did go through a tunnel.
You did go?
Yes, but I did see my dad in the light, motioning me to come forward, but I couldn't reach him. And what I saw in the tunnel was not, it reminded me of a scary movie with beings that were trying to grab me as I was moving forward.
And that fits very much with what Howard Storm described. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you very much. We learn a lot from these experiences. Go ahead, yes.
Your experience confirms my thought. Since or whoever is experiencing the tunnel, maybe for them it is necessary to experience that thing, and it could be a medium, like a presentation room that you have to go through to get a message. So the tunnel itself is a medium, like a billboard. It is in certain paint, it gives sounds, maybe you see colors moving. Whatever you experience doesn't mean anything. It may be something encrypted, but it may be a message that you just have to experience and that you have to hear on your way.
Thank you. Very interesting thought.
I was surprised by some of the statistics. I would have guessed that the tunnel would have been 50 or 60%, and Jesus might have been 10 or 20%, and Elizabeth 5 or 10%. And the buzzing before, I've heard of out-of-body experiences as well as near-death, but the clicking, the only place I've heard of that is alien abduction. It may all involve interdimensional stuff. So
there you go. Well,
the other question was, Have you heard in the last 24 hours about this national story of this surgeon who was against it, and then he had his own experience? I think it was in the last couple of years, and now he's a total believer. And it was in the national news.
Yes, there are lots of ways of entering into the spirit world. One most unusual one was a San Quentin inmate. The men that worked with me said that you better see this guy. He tried to suicide with many, many pills. And so we invited him over. He was a devout atheist. He was walking along at the side of a river, and everything was so dim and dark, he could hardly stand it. And then he saw an English telephone booth, and somebody was ringing it, and they looked around. He didn't see anybody, so he finally answered the telephone, and the guy said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "You don't belong here. Go on back and get back with your group and do something, make yourself alive." And interesting as I remember, I may be wrong, but I think he was in for killing his wife. But there he was, and that was a way of access. And he came back, and oh, he was a devout Jewish person.
Interesting. So I guess God grew up in London. What can we say? No, that's a fascinating comment. You know, I won't comment on that. But go ahead.
On the light, on the tunnel going towards the light, and someone mentioned Howard Storm may have seen in rounded corners, but when people have shared death experiences, like the lady a couple months ago, you get the physical distortions of things, and so perhaps that's could be what he was running into. And yeah, tunnels come in wide varieties. I think Betty Eady like got sucked out of the whole universe. You know, they're traveling mega light speeds. And so, and the one girl that was here like maybe a year and a half ago, where she had such a hard time dying, and she started saying, "Give up the ghost," you know, and this thing sort of showed up like a kind of some tornado looking thing. I don't know if that could be different things. You know, the thing that sucks you out of the universe might be different than the thing that you can touch the sides with. Going towards the light is a good trend. So that's probably, if Howard Storm was seeing rounded corners in his hallway, that could be what was causing that.
That could very well be. Who was here when Dr. Melvin Moore spoke a couple of years ago? One of the most fascinating experiences that I have ever heard from him, and I believe he shared that night, was of a young boy who was, I think, 6 or 8, not very old, was in a car with his mother and sister, and it went off the road close to a bridge and went off down into the water in wintertime. And he died, was ultimately rescued from the car. He said, "Dr. Morse, I had this wonderful experience. I went through this big noodle with a bumblebee." That to me would be a perfect example of somebody describing a near-death experience based on all the experience they've had at that young age. I mean, how else are you going to describe some amazing, "It's a big noodle. And how are you getting there?" "Well, it has to be with some bumblebee because you hear this buzzing sound." And those are the ways that you hear these experiences described. Any other comments on the tunnel aspect here?
When you're talking about that you relate the experience to your earthly experience and your religion, mine was so incredible that I could not relate it to anything religion-wise, but understand that I grew up in hellfire and brimstone and God's going to get you. Everything was love and everything was light. Even when I was having my life review, and the person that I suppose, it's very hard for me not now to call him Jesus, but at that point, I did not call him Jesus or think of him as Jesus. But I had also had a near-death experience as an infant, and so that may be the reason. And I want to make a comment on that, because this has come up with a number of people that I've been talking to my infant near-death experience wasn't something I remembered, but it happened at 8.5 months. And the reason I know about it is because of my family talking about it and my extended family and the transformation that I went through within 3 weeks. I went from a squalling baby to walking, talking, and potty trained within 3 weeks. I didn't know what any of that was about until PMH Atwater spoke about the markers of an infant near-death experience, and I had all of them. And then I talked to her after that. So I did remember when I went over that I had been there before. Go back to the near-death experience of my infancy. I had night terrors as a small child, and they were terrible. And I would wake up screaming. I've come to wonder in the last few months because of talking to other people and their children were having night terrors. I'm wondering if many of those children, if the parents investigated, if they did not have a near-death experience at some point. And I refer back to PMH Atwater's research and some of her writings. I just wanted to bring that up in case anybody's dealing with it.
Interesting. Thank you. I know very little about infant and NDEs. Thank you for sharing that. Let's move on to one other topic here, and that is the border or limit. Some of the near-death experiences that I've read from the Middle Ages really emphasize this. There was a guy whose name was Anselm, and he wrote of a near-death experience at the time of the great plagues in Europe. He had been a soldier for a while, and then he'd come back to London, and he fell ill to the plague. He describes, as he expired, that he left the town that he was at, and he describes going over a bridge and realizing that if he got to the other side, that there was this limit, there was this wall, as he described it. And he knew that if he went past that point, that he would not be able to come back. And so that was when he had to make his choice. Am I going on to the next life or am I coming back? Another kind of amusing one that I heard was from a critical care nurse who also used to be part of our group years and years ago, named Janet McClellan. She was up at the University of Utah, and there was a very angry and quite wealthy man there who'd had a heart attack, and he told all the nurses, I think he was quite afraid of dying, he told all the nurses and the doctors that he had been in touch with his lawyer and that if they didn't take really good care of him and keep him alive, that there were instructions to sue the nurses and the doctors and whoever didn't take care of him so that he died. He was just threatening everybody, and everybody was on pins and needles. His heart stopped, and everybody's going, oh, the crash cart comes in, and they brought him back, and he was yelling at everyone for letting his heart stop and letting him get this close to death, and I'll have you sued if you don't keep me here. If I die, I'll really have you sued, you know, things like that, which is kind of a funny comment. And then, sometime later, he died again. This time, it was for several minutes, and they were really worried. They were trying to bring him back. And this time he came back and he described this border or limit. This time it was the reverse. Why did you bring me back? It's so great over there. Don't you dare bring me back. If you bring me back again, I'll be here and I'll sue you. I guess you're toast either way. Yeah, some guy who went to law school twice and still didn't get it right. Anyway, so the other interesting point of that experience was not just the border or limit that this guy experienced on the other side, but the one that was here, because in fact, he finally had a third heart attack, and as was their duty and obligation in the hospital as doctors and nurses, they tried to go in and revive him again, and Nurse McClellan said, we tried, but we couldn't get to him. I said, what do you mean you couldn't get to him? Well, there was just something in the way. There was an obstacle. Well, what do you mean there was an obstacle? Could you see? No, there was, a wall or something that stopped us from getting to him. So there was some kind of border or limit on this side of the veil that stopped him, and he died, and everybody worried about being sued, but none of them were. So I guess all's well that ends well. The border or limit. why would there be a border or limit, and what does it indeed represent? Obviously, the people who describe it say if you go beyond it, you can't come back, but why not? I mean, if you cross the street, you can still come back. You know, if you go 5 miles here, you can still come back. Maybe if you jump out of the airplane without a parachute, after a certain point, there's a limit and you can't come back. But this doesn't seem to be life-threatening. You're already dead. What is the point of the border or limit? Bill?
Well, I have a theory. The theory is the near-death experience is not about dying. It's about living. And that if you really completed the journey, it would not be a near-death experience. It would be a death experience, and you wouldn't be coming and sharing it with other people. I believe the reason that you have the border is that because the message or the aspects of the experience that individuals have really is more about coming back and integrating those aspects into your life. I mean, I've heard some very extensive near-death experience, and I've heard some very brief ones. There's always a limiting factor, always. If there wasn't a limiting factor, it wouldn't be a near-death experience. They would be dead.
I agree with you. It seems to me that if you get too much knowledge or too much information by going beyond that border limit, you somehow don't get to come back, because it would thwart your purpose for being here, or at least part of your purpose for being here. At least that's my speculation.
I mean, there's no question about that. But I think that people get really focused on the death aspect of it. Really, the true beauty and the real message of the near-death experience is what that person brings back and what they are able to either incorporate into their life or to share with others. That's the ripple effect of the near-death experience. And so that's why there is that limit, because it's really about a person's life continuing. It's not about a person's life ending.
Very true. Thank you for that. Yes, sir.
The common element typically is you have a choice to make. There's more you need to do. In the case of this one fellow that I knew personally, he was standing in the emergency room up above his body talking to the angel of light, and he said, two things you need to know. If you go back into that body, it's going to be a lot of pain. Secondly, if you choose to go back into that body, there are two more daughters for you. These near-death experiences are not an accident. They occur sometimes around accidents, but they, as Bill said, they're for you to give you an extension to what you can accomplish in this very brief thing called life. Earl was the kind of guy, let's go back, and slam, he was in his body, and the pain was so extensive he blacked out. And when he came around, he was in the body cast. He called Lois over to him as soon as kind of the crowd got down, and he talked to this guy. There's two more daughters for us. Well, she was 50. He says, Earl, I don't know who you're talking to. Before he was out of the body cast, his son's wife committed suicide. His son was running a sawmill business, and he said, Dad, I need help with the girls. And these two teenage girls came to live with him and ultimately were adopted by him at the son's request because of what they could give him insurance-wise, etc. And while he was in the body cast, you know, the old Book of Mormon was up on the shelf. This occurred in Spencer, New York. And he read it. And not only did he and Lois come into the church, but these two teenage girls came into the church and are sealed. And voila. So his great purpose in his experiencing the pain and coming back, and it was his choice.
Very interesting comment.
I'm Angie Fenimore. I attempted suicide 20-some years ago, and I'm also the author of Beyond the Darkness. In this physical world, things are measurable. We have all science who can check things out. And so when we come back from a near-death experience, we're coming back with whatever we have, like what you were talking about when I came in, the noodle and the bumblebee. All I can speak from is my own experience, and that was that it was full of boundaries. It was all boundaries. It seemed to be like a finer molecular makeup of substance, of mass, much like water and air, or maybe the stratosphere, different levels of oxygen, and that it was a natural ordering. When I first went into my near-death experience, I went right into my life review. And then when that was complete, I was surrounded by darkness. And this, the darkness had an energy about it. And it was containing me as well. Like it was alive and had a purpose. And then I was with a bunch of teenagers in a row, and we were contained in this space. But I think that it had to do with our thoughts, who we were, what our essence was. We were, I'm done. And that was very present with them. And then I was taken to another space, and the energy was different there. And this boundary extended. It was a long beltway, and it was about as deep as from the back to the front here of this room. And it extended for as far as I could see and beyond what I could see. And that was a containment. Everyone in that containment had attempted suicide. I was clear about that as I approached it. And then I saw Heavenly Father approach, or God approach, and he was stopped by this barrier, could not come in. Like I said, we don't have any science to measure this, but I would say that it had everything to do with what we were constituted of. What God is constituted of cannot exist, just like a shark can't exist outside of water, period.
I invited Angie to make a comment about the suicide people there and how they were limited. And I think that you've just done that very, very well. And the fascinating thing to me is that if I remember your description well, these people could have gone into a better place at any time if they would have just looked up or looked over or been willing to try that, but they were stuck based on their own personal limitation. I know I can't describe it the way you can, but
yeah, and
please help us with that.
I think that's why I'm alive, actually, is because I had a thought. I was looking at another man that was there, and you know, you just know things. It's just like knowledge is available, and I knew he'd been there for a very long time, and I had a thought, I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot. And that thought triggered the rest of the near-death experience. Then all of a sudden, there's a pinpoint of light out in the distance. It was the thought that I had. It changed my constitution in that moment. It elevated the light that was, you know, the little spark that was still there. And then what had me lift out of that place, it happened so fast, I didn't even know that it happened. I just realized I'm above the plane and I see everything below me, and around me are these angels. And it was a thought. I was shown what would happen to my children without me being present. In that moment, I was willing to try, and it was just like the tiniest little okay. That was all. It was just a little smidge of a thought, okay. And then all of a sudden, I'm out of there. I mean, what we're constituted of is dictated by our thoughts, what we think, and what we entertain. Not just fleeting thoughts, but I would say the thoughts that we give life to, if you will.
Thank you. Great, great comments. One of the most fascinating aspects of what Angie said is that being there seems to be somewhat self-imposed. It's not like people are clamoring to get out and God said, nope, sorry, you're stuck. To the extent you're ready to be out, you could go. As soon as you had that glimpse, you were even helped beyond what you probably could have even expected. I guess God is the ultimate psychologist. How could we expect anything else? And one of the more fascinating experiences I've heard was from this little girl, Crystal Merzlach, who's now all grown up. And she was in heaven in this wonderful place. And she was asked, do you want to leave? Do you want to go back to Earth? Oh, no, not going. No, this is great. I'm staying. Wouldn't you like to leave and go back to your family? Nope. I'm going to stay right here. You know, my brothers are mean. I don't like it so much. This is great. Heaven is wonderful. Well, wouldn't you like to see your mom? Yeah, I'd kind of like to see my mom. Zip, you know, and she was gone faster than she could not even think another word. So somehow there's this free will involved that is just enhanced beyond what we can imagine, and the bad seem to be really bad so that we can learn from them, and the good seem to be really, really good. Thank you for sharing that. That was great. Yes, back here.
I've read quite a few of the stories, and the barrier, I think, is there. But since we have our agency to choose, I think many times people are saying they're told, okay, this is what lies for you if you go back. This is what lies for you if you don't, but it's your choice. The ones that I've read, they've all chose to come back. And I think that's what that barrier is it's there, but we can always choose to go through it or to stay on this side.
It seems to have something to do with knowledge. And if you get too much, you can't come back. One of the most, I don't know, I thought it was funny. I guess I shouldn't laugh at a guy who was kind of an old Hells Angel style motorcycle rider who would never wear a helmet and had the rigid Harley Davidson style motorcycles without any suspension. And he described how he was riding his motorcycle out past Tooele, somewhere out by Skull Valley in Grantsville. I don't know exactly where it was. And he wasn't paying too much attention, and he rode across some railroad tracks that went through the road. And because he wasn't paying attention, his bike didn't have any suspension. It just tossed him off. And because he wasn't wearing a helmet, he kind of whacked his head on the pavement. If you heard him speak, he was a very, very neat guy, but he was not particularly well educated. And so when he said, I had this experience and I went and saw God and asked all kinds of questions and I had all the knowledge about the universe, why the earth was here, what's going to happen, everything. I knew everything. Really? You knew everything? Yes, I knew absolutely everything. All right, so let's hear about the earth and dinosaurs and the end of the world and how it all fits in with religion and science and all this. Well, it was all taken away from me, but I knew it all once. And it was just kind of so cool to hear that, because the gist of it, what he communicated was that if he kept that knowledge, he could not have come back. Somehow there was a choice to be made there that if he knew too much, he couldn't come back, which kind of explains, I guess, why we only see glimpses of the next life and we don't have constant complete contact. Yes, ma'am.
I had a question for you, Angie, and whoever else wants to respond. When you were talking about being in that place with other souls that you felt had committed suicide, do you feel like we can have an influence through prayer or meditation for them, or is it just their own life journey and it doesn't really matter? You know, because I know so many teenagers specifically that have committed suicide, and, you know,
yeah, definitely. You can have an influence. There's not a lot of difference between this world and that world. It's something that I include with my prayers all the time, and I highly encourage it. Something that happens for me since my near-death experience is when I happen to go stay at hotels that are haunted, they come and visit me, which is really interesting. I really get the impression they just want to be known. And they're letting me know, I know who you are, and I know you can make a difference. I know you know who I am. I think it's really about when you see something, you can't unsee it. You can't undo that experience. And so there's like a recognition there. I know I make a difference for people that come and visit me. I know I do. I'm clear about it. So I'd highly, highly recommend it. Whenever I have somebody who comes to me and tells me somebody in their life attempted suicide, I always share that with them. I have a friend who her son committed suicide about 5 years ago. She's had some pretty remarkable experiences around that. And he's actually come back and told her, you know, everything's fine, I'm good. And then I also have another really close friend whose brother committed suicide. And it was the same thing. He did come back to the family and say, I'm good now. Everything's good. You can quit worrying. It's not a permanent place. Just like if you lose your job, done with the ride. It's ever expansive. I don't think there's any end to life at all.
And going along with the suicide, most of the experience that I read about were those who have attempted suicide and then came back. I was reading a particular story where a lady had a near-death experience, went over, met with her mother and father on the other side, embraced them and whatever, and they were talking. And she looked over and saw, can't remember if it was her brother or a cousin, a young man, and she wanted to go hug him as well. And they said, no, you can't go hug him. He committed suicide, and there are limits, and you're not allowed to hug him. He's happy. There is direction for him to progress,
and to go on and better himself and whatever, but it is a different direction than what will be available for other people. As they talked, it seemed to indicate that how you live your life here will determine what opportunities and what avenues you have there, be it heaven or hell or whatever, but there does seem to be some limitations for various kinds of things. You can read into that, I guess, what you would like.
Back to the concept of limits. Thank you. We're going to move on to just a couple of other topics, and then we'll wrap things up tonight. Won't go too late. I'm sure we'll be done by 11:15 without any problem. totally kidding. I'm sure we'll be done by 8:30 without any problem. I had asked Bill to relate his comments. One of the things that's difficult to deal with when you hear a lot of near-death experiences, you hear them and you go, yep, that makes sense, yep. And you hear another one, sure, yeah, that makes total sense. Then all of a sudden, you hear one, you go, what? Where did that come from? And for me, until I really thought it through and talked to Dr. Morse, it was the little kid with the bumblebee going through the noodle. I'm thinking, where did that come from? And Bill had another thought about the most unusual aspect of a near-death experience that struck him as being incredibly unusual.
How many of you were here when Dr. Mary Neal gave her talk? The thing that struck me, and been involved with IONS for over 20 years, I had my own near-death experience, so I kind of came from a little bit of an educated perspective, but never had I heard someone share that they had been told in their experience that they were going to lose a child at some future date. I was kind of sitting back here as she was giving her presentation, and I kind of tune in, tune out of the meetings as they go on a lot of times, and she mentioned that, and all of a sudden it was like, whoa, where'd that come from? I had never heard that, and I thought, really, was that the gift of the near-death experience, or was that, if you will, the curse of the near-death experience? And for those of you that heard her speak and have read her book, it was really an incredible gift. One, the beauty of the child that she ultimately lost and was told that she would lose, but also the fact that she touched on another, something that I believe personally and that a lot of people have shared, and that is that very young children are still very connected to that other realm, and that she had a conversation with the son that she ultimately lost at 18 years old when he was about 4 years old. And he told her essentially very matter of fact that she had made a comment, when you're 18, we're going to do something special or whatever. And he just said, you know, I'm not going to live to be 18. And it kind of took her back, and she said, what do you mean? And very seriously, he told her, that's not my plan. That's not our plan. And so, I mean, that was something that I had never heard in a near-death experience, of somebody being told that they were going to lose somebody at a later date.
Very true. Thank you. So what does that mean? I mean, we all know something about the future. We all know none of us are going to live forever. Beyond that, we probably don't know a whole lot. This is more detail or more information than most of us will ever get. What explains that? Why would somebody be told that their child is going to die ahead of time?
I was made aware that my second boy would be taken at 7 when I was shown what would happen to my children. My oldest child, I was shown that he would get to about 20 or 21 years old and he'd be so dark. He was rendered completely incapable of performing any missions that he came here to perform because of my death. So what I was shown was what would be if I was dead. And there came a point with that oldest child where that moment came, and I saw him exactly like I saw him in the near-death experience. And he recovered from that, and now he's got 3 little kids, he's married, he's awesome. And my second child really was nervous for 4 years after that near-death experience, afraid I was going to lose him. And it came and went. But in the near-death experience, I was being shown, here's what happens if you take your life.
So they were alternative visions of yeah. what could happen. They were alternative views of this will happen in the future if you do this bad thing, and this is what will happen if you don't.
Yeah, I wasn't even shown anything except for this is what happens if you do.
You just had the bad result.
Exactly, because okay. that was the impetus for coming back, which, sure. you know, what would happen to them without me. Something that's really hard to articulate is how time is ordered. And sometimes we're shown things that are, this is a possibility, this could happen. I don't think it's so much handed to us like, okay, now this, and here, I'm going to tell you this. It's more like anything you need to know that's going to serve you, that's going to embellish your life and make a difference in your life is available for you to know. But we're creating our lives. We're just stuck in a linear ordering of things. And so we're not present that all things are actually created already. It's there and it's happened. And then we go through a linear fashion because of the rotation of the planets and time works the way it does in a physical plane. So I don't think it's so much you need to know this, your child is going to be taken, as much as it is this is information that's available to you if you want to know and if it's going to make a difference for you. That's just coming from my own experience of I was handed a whole bunch of stuff, and some of it I came back with and some of it I didn't. Everything I came back with was important for me to know to lead a really valuable contributing life.
Thank you. That's great information. I've struggled a lot with how can you have free will if the future is known, those kinds of questions, and somehow it all fits together. One last concept and then we'll wrap things up. One of the most fascinating near-death experiences I ever heard firsthand was from Dr. George Ritchie, who's since had his final death experience, and he was a real gentleman, and he was somebody that you believed what he said. You just knew it was real and it was not made up. And one of the most fascinating points of his near-death experience, I will actually quote briefly. And then I saw, infinitely far off, far too distant to be visible with any kind of sight I knew of, I saw a city, a glowing, seemingly endless city, bright enough to be seen over all the unimaginable distance between us. The brightness seemed to shine from the very walls of the city and the streets of this glorious place. And then skipping a little bit because the description is long, he talks about the people or beings that inhabited this beautiful city of light that he saw way off in the distance, that he come close enough to catch a glimpse of, but not really enter or get too close to, because, as he said, he wasn't quite ready. He said they had changed themselves into his, meaning Jesus or the being of light. He talked about him as being Jesus. They had changed themselves into his very likeness. Even as I asked the questions, two of these bright figures seemed to detach themselves from the city and start toward us, hurling themselves across that infinity with the speed of light. As fast as they came towards us, we receded away because I was not ready. I had seen an instant glimpse of this real, this ultimate heaven, but I was not ready. The walls closed around us, and there I was back again with Jesus, who still stood beside me. So he had this wonderful experience about seeing the ultimate end where people actually mold themselves into the likeness of deity. He said they were like him, and he said, I had never supposed that something like that could be, that people could actually make that kind of progress and have that kind of existence, which I found quite fascinating and quite comforting that that kind of progression is actually possible. There is an excerpt that's very similar to that that's in Return from Tomorrow. This is something that I sort of added to and took notes on when I had dinner with him once. The basic experience is in Return from Tomorrow, yes. Thank you for joining us tonight. I appreciate all your insights into near-death experiences. I just believe that we know the tip of the iceberg about what they are and that there's so much more to be learned from them. And I appreciate those of you who have shared with us tonight doing so that we can all learn more.